So we are happy to have Toby today giving this talk on Casimirian free energy for free fields and holographic theories in 2+1 on curved spaces. So Toby, please, you can start now. Thank you.
Fantastic. I can't bear to sit down and give a talk. I just can't do it. So I'm going to try and stand up. Hopefully that won't mess up the video. Can you see my screen okay?
Yeah, we can see your screen. Yeah.
Well, tell me if it doesn't behave properly anyway.
Yeah, we can see your screen and we can also see your cursor.
You can see the cursor. Good, good. Okay, fantastic. So firstly, thank you for the invitation to come to PI, but obviously that can't happen now. So thank you for the invitation to talk instead. This is my first remote seminar that I've been giving, so it's a slightly odd experience, we'll see. So I'm going to talk about, as Raghav said, Casimir and free energy for various field theories on curved spaces in 2+1. And this is work done in collaboration with Sebastian Fischetti, who's at McGill, and who I'm sure many of you know, Gary Gibbons, who needs no introduction at all, my two students, Cry, Chin Soat, and Lucas Wallace. And it's based on a number of papers over quite a few years now. And I should say right from the start, this isn't some, it's not a terribly fashionable thing, I think, to think about it. It's not going to involve entanglement entropy, and it's not going to involve JT gravity or black hole information. But it's really about some quite basic questions, which I sort of feel haven't really been explored, rather surprisingly, or maybe thought about. So I think there's lots of interesting stuff here. And certainly as we've been thinking about it, we found more and more interesting questions that arise. So I hope to tell you a bit about all of that. So the plan is the sort of setup is that we're thinking about three-dimensional relativistic QFTs, and we're going to put them on just a product, an ultra-static product of time with a two-dimensional Riemannian space. Let's call it sigma. And this is an ultra-static product. GTT is one, so this isn't some fancy, or minus one rather, this isn't some fancy, you know, GR cosmology black hole. This is a very basic sort of curvature, where really all the curvature is in this two-dimensional space, sigma. And we're going to take sigma to have some non-trivial geometry, but some prescribed area, and we're going to fix the area and think about deforming sigma. And I'll tell you a physical setting where this may be relevant, and that is in the physics of membranes that carry relativistic quantum field theories as degrees of freedom on. And by membranes, I think this is a, Raghav, this is a string seminar, isn't it?
Yes, Toby, it is. Yes.
Good. So you know all about membranes, but this is not that type of membrane. This, when I talk about membranes here, this will not be some M-theory membrane, a relativistic membrane. This will be a non-relativistic standard common or garden membrane. Okay, and the canonical example that we'll discuss is graphene, which is indeed something like a membrane with some Dirac fermions living on it. So we'll talk about the physical setting, I'll talk about some basic questions, and then I'm going to talk about what happens to the energy of a QFT in this sort of setting. So we've got our QFT sitting on a curved two-dimensional space, and we want to ask, what's the vacuum energy? That's the Casimir energy associated to it living on this curved space. And if we put the thing at finite temperature, we could think about the free energy. What's the free energy? Now, this is obviously some functional of the space, sigma. And so the question we really want to ask is, what does that functional look like? How does it behave? And we're going to look in some explicit detail at free theory, so the Dirac fermion and a scalar. And we're going to think about sigma being a round sphere of some prescribed area, and then think about deforming it and asking, well, how does the free energy or the Casimir energy at zero temperature change as we deform the space? And then I'm going to talk about holographic theories, And in the holographic setting, you all know all about holography and holographic CFTs. And in a holographic setting, one can make sort of surprising progress that we've no idea how to make in the free setting. So this is one of these examples where holography really gives you some beautiful tools to do things that seem rather non-trivial. And I'll tell you also about a little bit of ongoing work that seems sort of rather surprising at the moment. Okay, so I should say, do stop if you have any questions. I know it doesn't, it's quite difficult to sort of ask questions over Zoom, but please do if I'm going too fast or I'm confusing people. Okay, so let me start with a sort of classical prelude for this. The idea that we're very familiar with classically is that classical matter gives a measure on geometry, and an example of that is sort of bending energy that you can give to a two-dimensional membrane that's embedded in three-dimensional space. So let's call the geometry of that membrane again sigma. And let's say, for example, it's got spherical topology, then you might write an energy functional like this, where kappa is the bending rigidity and g is the induced metric, k is the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And for this action, the round sphere of radius r, little r, minimizes this action, and anything else, it's positive. So the global minimum is the round sphere of radius r. And another way to phrase this, maybe more akin to the way we're going to think about it, is if we've got our 2D geometry sigma, and we think about fixing the area of that to some whatever number you like, and then we think of the energy just given by this extrinsic curvature trace squared, that again, that's essentially the Wilmore functional. And again, it's minimized by the round sphere. Okay. So this is, you know, very, very familiar. And what we really want is a sort of quantum field theory analog of this. And how is that going to work? Well, we're going to take our relativistic QFT. We're going to put it on an ultrastatic product, or trivial product of time with some space sigma. We'll put it in vacuum or at finite temperature. And then we want to essentially ask, well, what geometry does the QFT prefer? How does it respond to different geometries? I mean, in the classical example, we know the round sphere for that action minimizes the energy. Is that the same sort of thing that happens in the QFT setting? Now, if we're going to ask about an extrinsic quantity like energy, in order to compare different geometries, we should fix something extrinsic. And so we're, just as in that classical example, we're going to consider fixing the area of our space sigma. And then we really are interested in the shape deformations at fixed area. Okay. And we'll also sort of compare typically to a canonical geometry that I'll call sigma bar here. So for example, for a lot of the talk, we'll have in mind the round sphere as sigma bar, and then think about how the energy changes as we deform the round sphere. Later in the talk, we might also talk about the torus. Now, of course, Casimir energy is a very, very, you know, dates back to the 1950s with the work of Casimir, but there's been a huge amount of work on it, very beautiful work. And so you might wonder, isn't this all known? And I think, as far as we're aware, rather little is known about these general properties of Casimir energy. So the sort of things that I'm interested in this talk are, what are the general properties of these Casimir energies or free energies at finite temperature as you change sigma, rather than what has been focused on, which is computations of Casimir energies for particular theories on very particular and usually very special spaces. There was a lot of work in the 1970s computing sort of very elegantly zeta function regularized energies or partition functions on various very nice or special spaces. But that sort of very elegant analytic mathematical work is exactly sort of orthogonal to where we want to go. We want to sort of discuss generalities and trying to understand that problem. I should say that there's in this sort of Euclidean setting of three-dimensional QFTs, then three-dimensional Euclidean CFTs have had some attention in recent years with some very nice papers looking specifically at the squashed sphere, the Burgess sphere, which is a one-parameter deformation of the round sphere. And the motivation for that, I think, really is De Sitter CFT. thinking of that as the future geometry of the universe, and trying to understand how the partition function varies. So this is a sort of analogous to that, but again, we're not, that was, you know, so there is an analogous de Sitter CFT question, which I think has really been studied in this squash sphere direction. And we want to do something a bit more general, but also in this Lorentzian setting, this 2+1 setting, where we really have an energy and we're not just talking about a partition function. Now, so how do we proceed? So let's say we're working at some fixed temperature, T, and an inverse temperature, beta. And so the way we're going to think about the problem is we're going to define a free energy difference, delta F here, which is this functional of sigma. And sigma, I should say, we're going to have some prescribed fixed area. And we're going to difference the partition function on sigma from that on this reference space sigma bar and define the free energy that way. Okay, so that sounds simple, but of course these quantities are divergent. And so to make sense of these quantities, we have to regulate the theory with some cutoff, remove it and so on. And then we can worry when we renormalize, we're gonna have to introduce some counterterms to make things finite. And when you introduce geometric counterterms, you're going to have ambiguities, finite counterterm ambiguities associated to them. And so the immediate worry is this quantity delta F. Well, it may not be physical in the sense that you may want to talk about this sort of free energy difference between the space sigma and sigma bar, but it may depend on how you regulate your theory. So it may depend non-trivially on the finite parts of these local terms. And that's okay. You would then have to talk only about the non-local part, but it's somehow you couldn't really talk about the free energy. It wouldn't make sense as a quantity. So physically, however, let's just look at that in a bit more detail. We'll find actually the situation is better. So what we're going to do is we're going to introduce Euclidean time period beta to think about finite temperature, and we're going to put some coordinates on our space. Let's call them x. A metric on sigma is gij. So this is some arbitrary smooth metric function of x, but obviously all independent of Euclidean time. And then the analog of dE is pdV, which is obviously very familiar, is that delta F, the change in delta F rather, is given by this integral of the spatial part of the one-point function of the stress tensor, either in vacuum or the thermal state, integrated against the metric perturbation. Okay. Now this quantity, this one-point function, is obviously divergent. If you use a covariant regulator, then with some cutoff lambda, say, then this covariant regulator, the divergence is a constraint to be local and covariant and conserved because the stress tensor is. And so the only options in power counting are the metric and the Einstein tensor, which correspond obviously to a cosmological term and an Einstein-Hilbert term in the action. Okay, so of course we could add these, but then the finite parts of these counterterms that we've added would give us some ambiguity in the stress tensor. However, one nice thing is that in this ultrastatic context, we're actually interested only in the spatial part of the stress tensor here, and the spatial part of the Einstein tensor vanishes. And that's related to the fact that if you think about the action, the counterterm associated to it, the Einstein-Hilbert term, is purely topological in three dimensions in this ultrastatic context. It reduces just to the Euler number on the 2D space sigma. And so there's no interesting dynamics in it. And so that's trivial. And then you just have this metric term. And if you go back and look at this expression here, and you can integrate it up, it's trivial. And you find that the divergences are just associated to the change in volume. But we're fixing the volume of this space. So actually, we get no divergences with the cutoff. And similarly, the counterterms that we have to add to make sense of our theory won't give us any ambiguities. The finite parts cancel between these two partition functions, the one on sigma and the one on sigma bar. So actually, this quantity is really a finite quantity. We should think of it as a good infrared observable, and it's unambiguous in terms of renormalization. So it's a nice thing to look at it from the perspective of quantum field theory. It's a nice physical infrared object. Okay. So some comments. Just a comment for the classical membrane, of course, the energy functionals we wrote down before were really sort of extrinsic functionals. They depended on the extrinsic nature of the embedding into R3. In our quantum field theory setting, what we're really doing is curved space-time quantum field theory. So it's really an intrinsic functional of sigma. But of course, you can get the non-trivial intrinsic geometry from some interesting embedding in just of a membrane or of some two-dimensional space sigma into R3. And so you can think both ways, depending on whether you want to think about it formally or not. So let me say a few more preliminary comments. Let's consider our round sphere as sigma bar. And then we can write the deformation of sigma as some vial scaling of the homogeneous space, G bar. So the geometry sigma is just described by one function over the sphere. And it has to obey this fixed area constraint. And then let's consider just small perturbations of the round sphere so that we expand to linear order about zero in this function F. And then the one-point function here of the stress tensor will have some linear response to the perturbation. Let's call it delta sigma. And some VEV on the round sphere sigma bar here. And under the assumption that the theory is a reasonable theory, so it's got a good static vacuum or thermal state, and the stress tensor on the round sphere is homogeneous, then you find that the delta F, just using the fact you're at fixed area and on a homogeneous space, delta F will be quadratic in the perturbation. So the round sphere is actually an extremal point of energy, just based on the symmetries, as you might have expected. And the actual change in delta F at leading order is just determined, in fact, by the linear response of the one-point function. Okay. Now, again, on the round sphere, the natural thing to do is to expand the metric perturbation in spherical harmonics. Let's say their coefficients are these FLMs. And then again, the symmetries imply this response of delta F, it's quadratic, and it depends on the coefficients of your metric perturbation with some coefficients AL. They only depend on L, not on M, because of the symmetries. And these ALs basically determine how the energy responds, the free energy or the zero temperature Casimir energy responds to the metric deformation. So again, the round sphere is an extremal point, as you might have expected. And the question then is, what do these ALs do? Are they all negative? As I put a minus sign in here for reasons that will become apparent later. But you know, if all the ALs were negative, then the round sphere would locally be a minimum of energy. It's perhaps what you might have expected. Certainly, you know, in the usual classical settings, that's the sort of thing that we typically consider in the sort of actions that we wrote down before. So the basic questions are, for say small deformations, what do these ALs, how do they behave? Are there some directions that are energetically unstable, meaning that they prefer to be, they prefer energetically to be deformed in those directions, or is it a global minimum or maybe maximum? And what about large deformations of the sphere? What do they do? Supposing the round sphere is some it's a local extrema, supposing it's, say, a local minimum, is it a global minimum? And is the energy bounded at fixed area as we deform the geometry a lot, maybe make it singular? So these are the sort of basic questions that we're really interested in here. And I'm going to try and answer some of those today. So one thing Sebastian Fischetti and myself wrote down some time ago, it's very simple to understand that for a CFT, there's a simple result for this leading order behavior of the deformation. So this only works at zero temperature for a CFT. And the reason everything is rather simple is that when you're on time process S2, it's actually vial flat. So it's basically related to a problem of perturbations, specific perturbations of flat space. And the one-point function response, linear response, actually is just determined by the two-point function on that flat space. And so it's sort of trivial to calculate. So it has a universal form. So delta F to leading order for small perturbations of our S2 for a CFT is determined in terms of the central charge, the CT, which is the coefficient that comes in the two-point function of the stress sensors on flat space for your theory. And then this sum over these the coefficients of the metric deformation squared that we had before. And this is the form of the AL that we had. So it's just some function of L. And, you know, for different theories, Dirac scalar, holographic theories, you could write down explicitly what the central charge is, of course. But the key observation here is unitarity tells you that the central charge must be positive. And that means that this change in free energy is always negative definite. So every perturbation of the space, the S2, wants to lower the energy. Zero temperature. So this is just, I've written delta F, but it's really just a Casimir energy. So every perturbation wants to lower the energy, which we found a bit surprising. I mean, I don't know. I guess we didn't really know what to expect. But anyway, I find that a little bit surprising. And so it sounds as if QFT wants to destabilize a round sphere. Does that mean anything? What is this? This is some, how do we... mechanically, what does it mean that we've computed some energy on some fixed geometry? Is there some physics associated to then the dynamics of that? And the physical setting where I think you can give some sense of dynamics and idea that this is leading to some instability is in the setting of membranes like materials that carry relativistic quantum field theory degrees of freedom. And so the picture we have in mind is to think of some sort of non-relativistic membrane, which we treat classically. So we're thinking of a Born-Oppenheimer-style approximation. So we think of the material as being some sort of membrane with a quantum field theory on it. And the membrane's non-relativistic, and we treat it classically. Maybe it has some local membrane action function on it. And then we've also got these other degrees of freedom, which are the QFT, which we treat quantum mechanically. They're like the fast degrees of freedom, and we can integrate them out. They live on the geometry induced by this geometry sigma induced from living on the membrane. You integrate them out, and they give then some non-local contribution to the total energy or free energy of this system. So, for example, if we're thinking of an energy at zero temperature, we would have this classical membrane action, maybe of the form we had earlier, this the one that favors the round sphere. And then we've integrated out the quantum field theory degrees of freedom and then got some non-local functional also of the geometry G or sigma here. Okay. And then one can ask, well, in this combined system, if this quantum part disfavors the round sphere and this classical part favors the round sphere, which one wins? What happens? And there's an interesting physical example of this, and that's monolayer graphene. So monolayer graphene, you all know all about graphene. It's a peculiar substance, and on large scales, it apparently looks like a classical sort of membrane carrying two Dirac fermions with an effective speed of light about 1/100 that of the real speed of light. And it is believed, the state of the art seems to be that one indeed, when you deform the graphene sheet on large scales, larger than the unit cell scale, where it looks like a continuous membrane, so much greater than sort of angstrom scales, then the low energy fermion degrees of freedom look like a Dirac theory on the curved geometry that the membrane has been given. Okay. There are some subtleties with strain, so you may also have a Dirac field and a gauge field, but certainly you can pick configurations where the gauge field vanishes and you just have the Dirac theory on some curved space. Now, the bending rigidity of this system, thinking about the classical membrane action, the bending rigidity is estimated to be around an electron volt. I mean, none of this is particularly well understood. I mean, sort of precisely understood, but it's believed from experiment to be around that. And one of the interesting things is a number of years ago, maybe over 10 years ago, it was found that if you take monolayer graphene and suspend it freely, which is sort of incredibly impressive people can do this, and then image it using scanning tunneling microscopy, it actually prefers a crumpled or rippled structure rather than a flat structure. And the ripples are on a scale, say 50 angstroms, a fair bit larger than the unit cell scale, so where you think you should probably be able to consider this as a membrane, as a continuous membrane, but they're not on super long scales. And it's also true that these ripples seem to be static. So it was initially thought this was something to do with the lack of crystalline structure at finite temperature that membranes are known to have, but it seems not to be that. It seems to be an issue of ground states. I should also point out that if you just do a bit of Googling, there seems to be an awful lot of interest in creating monolayer graphene spheres. We're really interested in sort of thinking about spherical geometries and deformations, and certainly people are interested in making monolayer graphene spheres. Here are some actual microscopy images of the ripples on the surface of graphene. It's rather remarkable. Anyway, so just going back to this sort of simple physical example, because the Dirac theory is a CFT, the massless Dirac theory that lives on the graphene is a CFT, we already know perturbatively what how the energy at zero temperature behaves, so we can already do this calculation. So just plugging in what we had before, writing the free energy in terms of this part here, so these Fs, remember, are the coefficients describing in the spherical harmonic basis the deformation of the sphere. These As, Qs here, which take this form, are just the CFT form of the leading quadratic variation in the energy for a CFT. And this AC here is just what you get if you take this membrane action and expand it to quadratic order. And you see that then there's some competition between these two terms, which is characterized by a length scale for a configuration that where if you didn't have the quantum part would favor a round sphere of radius R in the classical part of the action. There's a length scale gamma, and one finds that the long wavelength perturbations, say the L equals 2 mode, which is the first one, the longest one, are unstable if the sphere is smaller than this characteristic length scale gamma. So if you make the sphere small enough, it will become unstable with the Casimir energy dominating, the negative Casimir energy dominating the positive classical action. However, of course, the immediate thought is, well, hang on, how small do I have to make this for this to work? Surely the electron Casimir contribution for being sort of a rippled sphere rather than a round one must be absolutely tiny. So you would have to make the sphere way, way, way smaller than the size of a unit cell in order to see this effect. It's got to be irrelevant compared to the sort of local membrane action part of the energy. In fact, if you plug in, this is what I found quite exciting at the start. If you plug in parametrically numbers, you find that actually the scale is reasonably large. I mean, it's something like 25 angstroms is this scale gamma, and you've got to be at smaller scales than that, but you've still got a bit of wiggle room between that scale and the sort of an order of magnitude lower, which is the unit cell size. And so we thought, well, this is not far off the scale that ripples are actually seen on, 50 angstroms. So maybe this has got something to do with the rippling. However, in our most recent paper on all of this, because we started to think about these spherical actions where we can precisely write down this free energy or energy difference, we can put in all the right factors of pi, and they sadly work against you to take this number down by a couple of orders of magnitude. So it turns out that this gamma really is sub-unit cell scale, you know, only by a factor of 10, but it's almost certainly, well, presumably it's not then relevant for graphene. So graphene spheres are not going to want to deform when they're small. And we sort of already, we know buckyballs don't deform. So maybe we knew this already. It's consistent with that. You might have also thought, well, anyway, so I don't want to talk too much about this, but one obvious point is that, you know, there's a lot of interest in monolayer materials now. Graphene is one of them, that's the starting one, but there's lots of different ones now. And it may be that you can make materials that have a lower bending rigidity, and it could be this effect then is important in, you know, in the dynamics of those sort of membranes. So I'm now gonna, maybe I'll pause for questions at that point, but we're gonna leave the physics and sort of concentrate more on the formal questions now. But maybe I should pause in case I've lost people. Has anyone any questions? Right, I will carry on then. Okay, so let's now just return to the formal question. How does the energy or free energy function depend on sigma? How does it behave? So let's look at free theories to start with quickly. We'll look at the Dirac fermion, we'll look at the scalar. When I've got a scalar and 2 plus 1 on a curved space, it's natural to include the marginal curvature, scalar-curvature coupling. And to start with, we'll just ask this perturbative question. We already solved it at zero temperature for the CFT, but what about these free theories in general? I should say we're also going to add masses and be at finite temperature. So these aren't CFTs, these aren't conformally invariant systems anymore. So we have to work a bit harder to solve them. In the end, what we really want to do is to understand the determinant of some linear operator, differential operator, and in both the Dirac fermion and scalar case, that differential operator takes this form. Because of the ultrastatic geometry, you factor out a time part, there's a mass m, which we can give to either field, and then there's some non-trivial two-dimensional differential operator. And this little sigma here, which we'll carry around for some of the talk, is either minus a half or one in the usual way for a scalar or a fermion. In the case of the scalar, this differential operator L is obviously just the Laplacian plus this marginal curvature coupling term. What's a bit less obvious is that you also have a similar form in the Dirac case. So normally you would think, well, I've got this spinner structure and a first order operator, but it turns out in this ultrastatic 3D setting, you can reduce it to a single second order operator acting on scalar functions. And anyway, then we're going to approach the calculation of the energy difference or free energy difference by computing it using a heat kernel for reasons that will become apparent soon. It's rather convenient in the setting. So just to remind you, the heat kernel of some operator L is defined as this trace over e to the minus heat kernel time t, nothing to do with real time, times the operator. And so the free energy can be expressed in terms of partition function, which is expressed in terms of an integral over the heat kernel function. So once you've got the heat kernel for your operator, you can then compute, well, all sorts of things, but in particular weighted in this way, integrated over this heat kernel time t, it computes this determinant to the appropriate power, well, with this factor here. Now, because of this nice structure of the operator, because the fact time and the mass factor out here, this heat kernel also factorizes. And in fact, what we're really interested in is this difference free energy. So what we need to look at is this differenced heat kernel just for the spatial part of the operator. Okay. And that different heat kernel for the spatial part of the operator is then integrated against some factors coming from the mass of the field and also from the temperature. This function theta is some associated to the sum over the Matsubara modes on Euclidean time. And so really what we're interested in doing is just calculating this, what I'll call the difference heat kernel, delta K, okay, as a function of the, as a function of sigma and sigma bar. So we'll fix sigma bar to be a round sphere here, and then we'll deform sigma to be some deformation at the same area as sigma bar and compute this. One thing to note is that this theta is positive. And so in particular, if we find that delta K has a definite sign as a function of T, then delta F will have a definite sign. And that definite sign of delta F will be independent of the mass and temperature of the theory. And that is something we will actually find. And that's one of the reasons it's being convenient to think about heat kernels. Okay, so I'm going to spare you the details. I don't have time, and I'm sure you would rather not see them. But this differenced heat kernel times sigma, because really it's this combination of the two that influence the direction this free energy is going in. This combination here, when you compute it in perturbation theory, it's a simple calculation to do. Well, there's a bit of work, but I mean, it's very straightforward. You determine these, again, it's quadratic in the metric perturbation described by these FLMs. And what you're really trying to compute is some functions of heat kernel time and L. And they have some explicit form given in terms of eigenvalues of the unperturbed operator L bar on the space and some coefficients here and some sum over those over L's in that. But the long and short of it is, I mean, there's some expressions that we derived, but they do simplify a lot when you look at odd L perturbations, so odd parity perturbations. These betas vanish, you just get alphas, and this sum actually terminates at L over 2. These then have some relatively simple expressions here, which you can compute in the scalar case or the fermion case. And what we see is that indeed they have definite signs. So we see, you can see it explicitly here. By the way, these are some ratios of gamma functions. These are Pockhammer symbols, ratios of gamma functions. But it's these quantities here are negative. Okay, and even in the even L case, it's also true. Less obvious, we couldn't prove it, but it is true if you just compute the things. That this function here is always negative, okay, for all L and for all T that we could look at. Okay, and so what that means, the conclusion is therefore that this this differenced heat kernel also is negative definite as a function of T, the heat kernel time, and therefore when we integrate it like this to get the free energy, we always get a negative free energy difference. So the round sphere is sort of a local maximum. Every deformation wants to bring down its energy or free energy, and that is independent of temperature, independent of the mass of the field. And in the scalar case, we can see here there's a curvature coupling psi, and it's independent of that as well. So there's obviously some reason why this is true, or I mean, I say obviously, I don't know. I mean, maybe there is no reason, maybe it's just coincidence. But it seems that, you know, the CFTs didn't like the round sphere, and these free fields also don't like the round sphere. And they don't like the round sphere at finite temperature, zero temperature with masses, you know, rather generally. Okay. I should also say that actually it's not true on any space. We also looked at in a previous work in the Dirac fermion on a torus, and there are a small number of modes on a torus that may have the opposite effect. So whilst on the sphere, every mode seems to want to make the free energy decrease, there can be specific modes on a torus where that's not true. Most of them do want to make it decrease, but for at least for the Dirac fermion, it's not. There's something about the sphere, but of course the sphere has more symmetry. So then the natural question is, okay, well, that's perturbation theory. What about large deformations of the sphere? How does the free energy behave then? So is the sphere a global maximum of the free energy at fixed area? Well, the first thing to say is that for these free theories, it is just a geometric problem. And if we were clever enough mathematicians, maybe we could just prove something like that if it were true. We have no idea how to do that. Mathematicians do study regularized determinants of differential operators. And so it is entirely possible that someone could prove this. And maybe to them, it's a rather simple problem. We don't know how to do that. But you know, if anyone has ideas, then I would be very interested to hear. At small and large t, this heat kernel function, it's straightforward to see that actually it does have to have this definite negative sign, non-perturbatively, so not just for small deformations. For small t, there's something called the heat kernel expansion, which allows you to explicitly deduce the form. The leading behavior at small t is actually linear in t with some constant, depending on the theory, a positive constant in these cases of the fermion and the scalar, and some four derivative curvature term in our case, which you can, quantity, this curvature functional here, you can prove simply at fixed area. Where we're deforming relative to the round sphere, it's always negative definite when sigma isn't the round sphere itself. So we can show that at small t from the heat kernel expansion, this does have to be negative non-perturbatively. And actually at large t, the behavior of the heat kernel is governed by the lowest eigenvalues of the operator. And there are geometric bounds on eigenvalues for scalar operators and for Dirac operators. And using these again, you can show that actually sigma delta k, this quantity, this difference t kernel, again, with this factor of sigma, is negative at large t, non-perturbatively. So that's nice, but of course, we've no idea what it does in between, and the free energy is an integral over all t, so still all bets are off. So what we decided to do was to have a look at actually some deformations, some explicit examples to see. I mean, maybe it would just be obvious that you would find that it didn't have a definite sign, that you could have very positive free energy differences for certain deformations that are large. Who knows? So anyway, we had a look. So we computed delta K by numerically considering axisymmetric deformations of a sphere. So we take an embedding function that's axisymmetric, so it only depends on a polar angle in R3. And then it induces some axisymmetric metric on our two sphere, our deformed two sphere. And then we choose some embedding function or some family of them. And then we just explore what happens. And for no particular reason, but partly to compare with the perturbation theory for small deformations, we took deformations that were generated by taking this R to be some constant, the round sphere, plus a parameter epsilon that we'll think of varying times one of the YL zeros, so an axisymmetric spherical harmonic. And we can do this for different Ls, and this constant C is just there to preserve the area. We've got, as we deform in epsilon, we have to rescale things to keep the area fixed. And so, I mean, I'm always very happy to talk about numerics, but I'm not going to tell you about it. It's relatively straightforward to do all of this. And actually, you can go quite a long way with the numerics in this axisymmetric setting. And we did it for the fermion and the minimal scalar. And the summary of what we found, I'll show you some results, but let me just summarize, is that for this family of deformations that we looked at and some others that I'll come onto in a minute, again, this difference T kernel does always seem to have a definite negative sign. And therefore, the free energy difference relative on these families of deformed geometries relative to the round sphere is always negative. They're always preferred relative to the round sphere at any mass, at any temperature, both for the fermion, and I should say we only looked at the minimal scalar just because, well, numerically there's only so much you can sort of test. But more recently we've also looked at the conformally coupled scalar, and the same is true there as well. Rather surprisingly, when you actually look at the form of this free energy difference, it's rather similar in structure for both the scalar and fermion. I'll show you some pictures. It's a little bit surprising. Let me go on and show you some of the geometries that you generate looking at this these one parameter families with this index L. These are the sort of things we looked at computing the energies of. The round spheres are in blue. They're the reference geometry, and then we look on these deformed geometries. You compute these heat kernel differences numerically, these delta Ks, as a function of heat kernel time. This is actually log heat kernel time, it's a log scale here. And I've normalized by epsilon squared, which remember is the leading, that's how the leading deformation goes as you deform away from the round sphere. But it also, it's a nice normalization. Now, what you should read from all of these is that all of these heat kernel difference heat kernel functions are indeed positive. With this minus sign included, and therefore, sigma delta k is always negative, and as I said, that implies therefore that the free energy difference for all of these families is always negative relative to their round sphere at epsilon is zero. This is an interesting plot. This is a plot for different L's. So this is L of 1, 3, and 5, where we deform out in epsilon. And we look at the change in the energy. This is just the zero temperature energy integrated from those heat kernels divided by the perturbative result, which remember goes like epsilon squared. And so it's normalized, it's a nice normalization, which means these curves should go to one here, small epsilon. That's a good check of the numerics. And they've got some form as you go away from epsilon. Note the sign is obviously always positive for this ratio, meaning the sign doesn't change for the energy. It's always going down relative to the round sphere. But also note that the solid line is the Dirac curve and the dashed line is the minimal scalar. And they are different, but they're not very different. And why they should have this very similar structure, who knows? I mean, we have no idea. So this is for the even L modes. This is L of 2, 4, and 6. Again, rather similar curves. Again, you can see a bit more of a difference here for L of 6. So they're not the same, but the behavior is rather similar. I'll skip over this bit a bit more quickly because I want to get onto the holographic theories, this being a string seminar. But we also looked at conical, a different family of geometries that end in a conical deficit. They interpolate between the round sphere and a conical singularity. And we looked at conical singularities with both an angle excess and deficit. The angle excess can't be embedded. You have to just think of them intrinsically. So for example, this is a family of geometries we also studied. And again, it is always true both for angle excess and deficit that the heat kernel, again, always has this definite sign that means that the free energy relative to the round sphere is always lower. Okay. If you've thought about Casimir energies on cones, on an exact cone, sort of a flat, a trivial cone, you would then think, you might think, well, hang on, angle excesses give you a positive energy difference, angle deficits give you a negative energy difference relative to flat space. Now that's true, but that very much depends on the asymptotic structure. Whereas if when we put the geometry into a sphere setting, it's always the same, the energy does depend globally on what's going on, and it's always true that the round sphere is preferred relative to these sort of deformed geometries that become conical. So maybe I should pause very quickly and just ask, are there any questions at this point before I talk about the holographic theories? So I'll take that as no questions. Okay, so holographic theories then, you all know about holography. I'm not gonna go through the, I'm gonna assume you understand well, probably better than me about them. But holographic theories are a very powerful tool to look at curved space quantum field theory. Because the setting is naturally geometric, it all just becomes a geometry problem, and you can use geometric techniques to sort of study it. So what we're interested in here is putting a holographic CFT on time cross sigma, this trivial product of time cross sigma. So we want Einstein metrics in the bulk with that correct conformal boundary. We can then compute the boundary stress density using holographic renormalization and then understand the energy in the theory, and also if there are horizons because you're at finite temperature, any entropy contribution, and therefore the free energy. So the first thing to say is that if you're at zero temperature and say we take a sphere on the boundary, the bulk geometry is of course global ADS, and if you deform it just a little bit, then it's covered by this perturbative CFT result I discussed right at the very beginning. Okay, what we're now going to show is that actually, and it's very straightforward to prove that the change in energy as you deform sigma away from the round sphere is non-perturbatively always negative for a holographic CFT. At least I should say, I should be more careful, for a CFT with a two derivative Einstein gravity in the bulk. I'm also gonna, what we can also show is we have a sort of partial result at finite temperature. So at finite temperature, what we would like to try and understand is the free energy at finite temperature also less for a deformed sphere than for a round sphere at fixed area and temperature? What we can't prove is that, but what we instead can prove is that at finite temperature, the energy, not the free energy, which is of course what you'd like to look at finite temperature, but the energy difference is negative for a deformation of sigma from a flat torus, rather than the round setting, we're in the flat torus setting. So we can actually prove that. That was pretty hard to prove, and I'll sketch the proof because it's interesting, but it's definitely challenging. And it may be that one can go to this actually compute the free energy and in the round sphere deformation setting, but we sort of stopped partly with exhaustion. Anyway, if maybe at the very last, I'll sketch some actual numerical calculations of the form of these free energy differences. So let me just quickly tell you, at zero temperature, to show that, so if a global ADS, the energy is always zero, because it's a conformal theorem, in fact, the energy is zero for the two sphere on the boundary, time cross the two sphere. And so what we want to show is actually that the energy when you deform the two sphere is negative. That will tell you that the energy difference is negative relative to the round sphere. And a nice way to do it is to write the 4D bulk metric in this, what we call an optical form. It's static, so everything only really depends on three dimensions. And the three dimensional geometry here, G, rather than doing a Kaluza-Klein reduction where I would put in some lapse, I take the lapse and sort of treat it as an overall conformal function. And then it leaves this geometry G, which is usually called the optical geometry. And the optical geometry has the virtue here that it has a boundary. So we think of the optical geometry, I'll call it M. And it's got a boundary at the conformal boundary where this Z, which we think of as living over the optical geometry, goes to zero. But it's a real boundary of the space rather than some sort of conformal boundary. So, what have I done? So it's a real boundary. So that's quite neat. And then the bulk equations look like this. There's a sort of Einstein-like equation, and if you like a sort of equation for what you might call this scalar field Z, the scalar function Z. And the beautiful thing about the system is that, and it's not at all obvious, but following from these Einstein equations, you can show that this equation is true. So this is written in this optical geometry, this three-dimensional Riemannian geometry. You can show that the optical Ricci scalar R, that's the Ricci scalar of this, is a subharmonic function, meaning it's equal to something that's negative definite, constructed from the traceless part of the Ricci tensor. That's true, but it's not clear why it's nice. But if you now integrate this expression over the optical geometry, you then just get these boundary terms being negative. And these boundary terms being negative, when you compute the boundary terms, translate precisely into the boundary term associated to the normal gradient of R, it turns out, is basically the energy density. So you land up integrating the energy density and giving you the energy of the space, and you see that the energy of the space is negative with equality here only if the left-hand side, only if this quantity R tilde vanishes. And if R tilde vanishes, you can easily convince yourself that actually the boundary had to be a round sphere. So it's a very simple proof to then see that actually the round sphere is the global maximizer in this holographic theory at zero temperature for the energy. So this is at zero temperature. I mean, if you put in a tiny bit of temperature, you don't expect horizons in the bulk for these sort of solutions, because it's confining when you're on the sphere. And so this would also be true at small finite temperature. If you did have horizons in the bulk, actually, it doesn't change this argument, because the additional boundary terms, at least at zero temperature, disappear. So I think it's worth pausing and just emphasizing that in the free case, it probably is true that the round sphere globally maximizes the energy at zero temperature. It seemed to be true numerically. You know, we didn't find any examples where it wasn't true. It's plausible it's true, but we have no idea how to prove it. Geometers might do, I'm not sure. But here in the holographic setting, it's a very simple proof. And so it's worth sort of just emphasizing how neat that is. I just want to quickly, Raghav, how much time do I have? Do I have a couple of minutes?
Yes, you can take a couple of minutes.
Okay. So let me just talk quickly about what happens at finite temperature. We wanted to extend this result to finite temperature. Then, of course, the bulk, if you were at high finite temperature, would have a horizon, and this proof won't work, basically because you can prove, for example, that in fact, the free energy is negative, but what you're interested in is the difference of the free energy from the free energy of the round with a round sphere boundary at the same temperature and area. And so just showing, for example, that the free energy is negative, which is actually what this proof would generalize to at finite temperature, doesn't really tell you anything interesting. Because we don't know the relative difference between that and the round sphere, which is what we're interested in. Now, we couldn't do that in the spherical case, but we could make progress when we have a boundary torus rather than a round sphere. So let's look at the boundary torus. And unfortunately, we couldn't get the result for the free energy, but we could get it for the energy difference, not the free energy difference, but the energy difference, again, at fixed temperature and area. So we take our reference geometry to be a flat torus. The bulk is just ADS Schwarzschild, but planar ADS Schwarzschild and appropriately compactified. And we use the techniques that Robinson used when thinking about uniqueness of Schwarzschild. You use the idea that ADS Schwarzschild is conformally flat and cohomogeneity one. And so you start by looking at the Cotton tensor of the optical geometry, and that vanishes for ADS Schwarzschild because its spatial sections are conformally flat. Okay. So spatial sections are conformally flat, the Cotton tensor vanishes. We then define another function here, a scalar, from this function, scalar function Z, and from the optical Ricci scalar, and some function H of Z, chosen such that this vanishes for planar ADS Schwarzschild at the temperature that you're interested in. Okay. Now, why can you do that? You can do that because ADS Schwarzschild is a cohomogeneity one metric. It only depends on a radial coordinate. And so there's just a the relation between R and Z is just a trivial function, which you can fix, which fixes this form H. So the fact this vanishes on ADS Schwarzschild because it's spatially conformally flat, this vanishes on ADS Schwarzschild by design. And from this, you can build a vector field from the scalar and Z. This then gets a bit more technical. I'm happy to discuss the details, but maybe after if people are interested. We take some function, just a linear system of ODEs, which we think of the variable being Z, okay? And if you take that, you can then construct a vector field from these functions, A, B, and C, and the Z and the optical Ricci scalar, all getting a bit technical, but don't worry too much. And this vector field then obeys a beautiful divergence theorem. So the divergence of this vector field is equal to some terms which the Cotton tensor, this vector field, and this scalar function, which are designed all to vanish on ADS Schwarzschild at the temperature that you're interested in. You have to pick the appropriate function H for that temperature. Okay, and so if, so this is the analog of this zero temperature expression we had. In fact, if A is one, B and C vanish, this actually reduces just to this simple expression. Okay, so again, we integrate it over the space. We get some boundary terms here. And if the functions A and C are always positive, these boundary terms are negative and are equal to zero only for this planar ADS Schwarzschild at the temperature that you're interested in. So can you find positive A and C? And what are these boundary terms? Well, if you look at ADS planar Schwarzschild, toroidally compactified, indeed, you can actually solve the linear system for these A, B, and C. And there's some constants of integration, but the long and short of it is you can find A and C to be greater than zero for all their argument in some range of a constant of integration, K, which we'll see the effect of in a minute. So K has to be positive, but it can't be too large. When you evaluate the boundary terms using these solutions for A and C, that you get at infinity, you get a term involving the energy of your theory and also the area of the boundary. And at the horizon, you get a term involving temperature times entropy, as you might expect, and also a topological term involving the Euler number of the horizon. So let's assume that we just have this toroidal Schwarzschild. As the boundary gets deformed, the horizon is still toroidal. Then this topological Euler number just vanishes. And what we're reduced to is these boundary terms look like, they look a bit like a free energy here, although this K, this constant of integration we had, actually can't be one. It can be between 0 and 6 over 11, irritatingly. Otherwise, we'd be very happy. And there's some area term as well here. And we have equality only for Schwarzschild. And so add our fixed temperature and fixed area. So once we fix the area, you can. This then implies that the difference of energy with this other term, if we want it, we can include this K, at least some of it, is indeed negative, comparing our deformed space, our deformed torus boundary and bulk to the flat one with its bulk of planar ADS Schwarzschild. Okay, so if we could take K to be one, we would have the result we want, that the free energy difference is negative, but we can't, or at least we don't know how to with this proof. It could be by thinking harder, we'd be able to. Okay, so let me just, in the 10 seconds, just say we're also actually doing some numerical GR calculations to deform the boundary and calculate the energy. And I'll show you this just because it's quite interesting. Before I plotted these curves, this is at zero temperature. I showed you some curves for deformations in free theory of the energy the deformed energy relative to the round sphere energy normalized in such a way that they went to one when you turn off the deformation. So normalizing by the leading perturbative behavior. And in fact, this is numerical data. And there are two sets of data on here. The red dots are the Dirac, free Dirac theory. And the blue dots are where we can get data for the holographic theories. And they're surprisingly close. Okay, you can't see by eye. They're within a percent of each other everywhere we could compute them. And we have no idea why that's true. But it's a little bit peculiar. Anyway, let me finish. I think I'm out of time. So as summary, we were talking about the Casimir vacuum energy at zero temperature or finite temperature free energy of these theories on curved two-dimensional spaces at fixed area and temperature. They provide some sort of interesting intrinsic energy measure on geometry, and it doesn't seem to have been explored very much. It may indeed have physical relevance to membrane materials like graphene and future membrane materials to come. There's lots of interest in these things. But the basic conclusion is that QFTs seem to dislike the round sphere, or indeed homogeneous spaces. They generally just dislike them. We've got some global arguments in certain cases. In the holographic case, free theories, actually, we don't have global arguments about round spheres being global maxima, but I sort of feel like they probably are, and it would be very interesting to understand that. And the similarity in the actual behavior when you compute these energy differences for different theories is rather striking. They seem to behave very, very similarly, even though the theories themselves look quite different. Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you for the talk, Bobby. We can now let the questions start. So if you have questions, please go ahead and ask them.
I baffled everyone.
So maybe I can ask one. So Toby, when you said that you can measure the energy difference, but not the free energy difference, and you mentioned about this K6/11 not becoming one, I didn't understand then completely. Like, what do you have to do to get to the K^1 limit of to get free energy?
In the method of proof we used, it just for whatever reason proof breaks. I mean, it's unfortunately very complicated. So it's one of these settings. If you can prove something's true, it's true. If you can't prove it's true, it doesn't mean it isn't true. It just means you couldn't prove it wasn't true. So we, in order to do this construction of Robinson, we had to construct a rather delicate identity. It really is complicated. I mean, when you go through the details, it really is very complicated, and I'm sort of surprised we even managed. But basically, in this construction, there are various things you have to do. And in particular, we had to find some peculiar in our construction identity, there were various constraints to make it work. And that's what constrained things. But the important point is, this is just, with this identity, you could prove the energy difference was always negative. And you could sort of go towards the free energy, but you couldn't get there. But maybe there's a better identity with some other terms where you can prove that the free energy is negative. But this one's already pretty complicated. So we didn't persist.
Okay, let's see. Okay, so if there are no more questions, maybe we can thank Toby. Toby, thanks for the talk.
And okay, thank you.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.